The Presidencies of the United States is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. Hello and welcome to the Presidencies of the United States. I'm your host, Jerry Landry. So as we are in the presidential election year of 2024, I wanted to do a special series of episodes where we talk about some of the past presidential elections that are still interesting and provide us with some insight and perspective that may have changed the course of history, or that we just like to geek out about and talk ad nauseum about, you know, whatever the case may be. But I think this one, we've got some stuff to talk about because it was a pretty impactful election. But before we get to our conversation, I would like to introduce my special guest for this episode, Howard Dorey of the Plotting Through the Presidents podcast and blog. Howard, thank you so much for joining us on Presidencies.
Well, thank you so much for having me here. I'm so excited to talk about this election.
Absolutely. It talks about one of your favorite presidents, John Adams. So I knew as soon as I reached out to you, I was like, we're going to be talking about an Adams election. Oh, yeah. But before we get into the election of 1800, Howard, I just want to give you an opportunity for anybody who hasn't stumbled upon your podcast yet, which I don't know how they couldn't. You are one of the big names in presidential history podcast. I've learned so much from you over the years, and just so thankful for your friendship as well as all the information that you share about presidents. But Howard, just share with the audience, if they haven't heard of Plotting Through the Presidents yet, what is the podcast? What do you do? And where can they find you?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I appreciate that, Jerry, and the feeling is absolutely mutual with what you do over there and the in-depth stuff that you provide to your listeners. So Plotting Through the Presidents, it's an irreverent history podcast. I co-host it with my wife, Jess. And really what we do is we dig into lesser known stories from presidential history and the founders and the early United States. And I just take deep dives into rabbit holes of stories that might not be covered elsewhere or might not be covered so much. And I bring them to Jess, who doesn't know what I'm going to talk about ahead of time. So her reactions are raw and human. And we have a little, you know, marital banter along with some deeply researched irreverent history that I hope can bring some fun knowledge to people who don't know anything about history. It's accessible to them. And even historians, I set out to have some stuff in each episode, if possible, that might be surprising or new to them, mostly because real professional historians probably wouldn't have the time or the reason to go into the weird things that I sometimes do.
You know, like pet alligators and
yeah,
possums.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, and that's what I love about your podcast. And of course, I highly recommend it to our audience. If you haven't listened yet, I'll have information on the page for this episode on the Presidencies website. But I love that you have a way of bringing it to more of a human element. You know, these stories that really help us to understand the people behind the names and dates and all that we learn in history, but then also challenging history that people think, oh, well, that's exactly what happened. And I especially think of JQA's pet alligator, the fact that you did kind of a myth buster on that. It helps us to remember that history is written by people, and sometimes they get it wrong.
Oh, definitely. And, you know, we shouldn't take every Snapple cap literally, you know, because the trivia and the facts behind those fun facts often just aren't facts. And you mentioned, you know, that we look at the personalities and the people. And that's one thing I love about the election of 1800, because you get to see some of the worst sides of some of these people, of Hamilton, of Burr, of Jefferson. And I'm sure we'll get to all of that, but that's one of the things I love about the election of 1800. And we've covered in several episodes from several different angles, looking at the rivalries and the strange things that went into who eventually won that election.
Absolutely. And Presidencies listeners, we covered this We just released the two-part Aaron Burr episode on the vice presidency series, and we talked about it kind of from Burr's perspective, but I felt that this was a good one to kind of do a little bit more of a dive into to really see what was going on, and especially to get Howard's perspective, knowing that, you know, he can really speak to this from Adams, but then also Jefferson, what was going on with them. I think that's going to be important to consider as we're going along. And to get us started, I think one thing to put this into context, this is only the fourth presidential election ever in the U.S. And it's only the second that doesn't have George Washington on the ticket, which means it actually has to be somebody other than George Washington who becomes president. So that in and of itself is an interesting place to be in and to really consider, because they were still trying to figure out how this presidential election stuff actually works.
I think we still are. But definitely back then it was the first time they were going through some processes that we still wonder about today.
Yeah.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939 when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era like Cuba and Vietnam. And I'll unpack the conspiracy theories, too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.
And what really adds the wrinkle to it and what ultimately made this election so memorable is that at that point, this was a time before the 12th Amendment. So this was a time before there was a designated electoral vote for president and a designated electoral vote for vice president. Everybody was just in this common pool. And with hindsight, of course, we're like, well, of course that's going to cause problems. But back then, they didn't really think about it, because when the system was originally put together, there were some people who were thinking about factions, but I think it went even further than those folks thought about. And there are some folks who really didn't see factions coming. They didn't see that this would become a thing. And therein lies the problem. When you've got a faction putting up a president and vice president, but the votes are just for president.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, it's bizarre to think that that's how things worked back then. But yeah, they had some rose-tinted glasses when they built that system, thinking that, you know, even if people had differences of opinions, you know, certainly they could work together. And they did in a lot of ways, but it wasn't the way to run an administration, was to have two opposing folks at the head of it, which is why the vice presidency was, you know, relegated to such a inconsequential role. I mean, it was from the start with Adams under Washington, but it continued to be so because not only did the vice president have one job, presiding over the Senate, you know, breaking ties. But as soon as the vice president wasn't on the same side as the president, there was no reason to have that person out front at all.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, 1796 was that odd combination of you have John Adams, who's running as a Federalist, you have Thomas Jefferson, who's running as whatever you want to call it. On presidencies, we call it Democratic Republican. But these were people on opposite sides who ended up president and vice president respectively. And of course, that's going to cause issues. You're going to have a vice president who is opposed to what's coming out of the administration. And so even if there was a chance of having the vice president a little more involved, that was going to completely take it off of the table.
Yeah, at least Jefferson kept his anti-administration efforts secret, which is awful, but maybe it's better than him going out and giving speeches about how much he hated Adams and how much the Federalists were ruining the country from his perspective. So yeah, I don't know. Is it better to work against your government in secret or to go out there and try to incite people to work against it publicly?
Yeah. Which of these bad situations is worse?
Exactly.
Well, and just speaking of the numbers, so for this election, there were 138 electoral votes total. So the magic number to win was 70. Going into this, folks had the context of the election of 1796 to look at, and they wanted to avoid this whole, you've got a president from one party and a president from another party, mm-hmm. or vice president from another party. They were trying to avoid that, except here we get to the problem, because Thomas Jefferson and Aaron Burr, who were supposed to be the Democratic Republican presidential and vice presidential candidates, respectively, both earned 73 electoral votes. But that's a tie, because it doesn't designate, folks weren't voting for Burr for vice president. They were just voting for president, and the next runner-up is the vice president. And we saw in previous elections, you know, when Washington was in the mix, you had folks like Hamilton behind the scenes telling electors, hey, throw your vote. You know, definitely vote for Washington, of course. Everybody's going to vote for him. But instead of voting for Adams, why don't you vote for John Jay? Or why don't you vote for this person or that person? So that they avoided this tie. The Democratic Republicans didn't have that going on their side. Everybody voted for the same candidates.
Right. And when John Adams found out about Hamilton doing that and talking to people to have that plan earlier on, I mean, that's just one of the sources of their contempt for each other. And I mean, you speaking of Hamilton and his role in the election of 1800, I think it's bizarre that when there's a tie between two candidates, the winner is actually decided by the former Secretary of the Treasury. He played such a big role in that election that in so many ways, I mean, you know, it's between Adams and Jefferson, and then it's between Jefferson and Burr. But in so many ways behind the scenes, it was an election between Hamilton and Burr.
Yeah. Yeah. Because at that point it was, and it's really interesting. It's fascinating that, so, you know, going through some of the other numbers. So John Adams came out with 65 electoral votes. So not enough to win, not enough to tie. So he's out of it. His vice presidential candidate, Charles Cotesworth Pinckney, earned 64. One vote was thrown for John Jay. Mm. So it's a weird combination of what's going on. But, you know, Adams at least is solidly in third place. But this was also a time where the electoral votes weren't necessarily decided by the people, because only six states at this point, you know, there were 16 states total voting, but only six had a popular vote. And so these six states were Kentucky, Maryland, North Carolina, Rhode Island, Tennessee, and Virginia. Mm. And even within those popular votes, there were so many different ways of doing things. So we typically think of, we've got a couple of exceptions nowadays, but by and large, electoral votes go to the winner of the vote, the popular vote in that state. Only Rhode Island and Virginia were electors chosen by a statewide vote.
Hmm.
Maryland and North Carolina divided their states into electoral districts, and each district chose one elector.
Okay. What did Kentucky do? Do you know?
So Kentucky, the state was divided into two electoral districts, and half of the state's electors were chosen by each district.
Okay.
Tennessee decided, you know what? All of this sounds really complicated. Let's go a step further. The state was divided into three electoral districts, and each district chose three people from each county in the district to elect an elector for the district.
Wow. I mean, yeah, it's lovely that states have the power to decide how their elections are run. But I mean, you look today at like caucuses where people are like moving chairs around in a gymnasium, and you wonder, like, how did we get here? Like, we still don't seem to be in a place where things makes sense to me anyway. Yeah.
It's really interesting to see that they, and like you said, Howard, we're still trying to figure it out, but at least with some of these, we've made it a little neater. And the fact that you had 10 other states that the state legislature chose the electors. Yeah. And so what we think of as the presidential election of 1800 for those 10 states was decided by the state elections and who ended up in the legislature. And so the vote was a very complicated thing at that point.
And that's interesting when you break it down that way and you talk about the different states like Virginia and Kentucky having that popular vote, because the Virginia and Kentucky resolutions that were written in response to the Alien and Sedition Acts, these secret things that Madison and Jefferson put together that sort of paved the way for secession and said, hey, if you're a state and you don't like a federal law, you don't have to follow it. Guys, let's get upset about this. And I know, especially in Kentucky, there were basically riots or mass protests. So riling up the people in those states, I never really thought about how that might have had something to do with the fact that there were popular votes in those states.
Yeah.
Jefferson, Madison, those sneaky, sneaky guys.
Yeah. And that's the thing, like so much was happening behind the scenes, and we see this with this election, you know, and the factionalism was so riled up by that point.
Yeah.
They were convinced that the other side, either taking power or retaining power, was going to lead to disaster for the nation. It was going to be ruinous, whether it was Democratic Republicans thinking that Federalists were just going to take over everything and, you know, create this new monarchy or aristocracy or whatever. And then vice versa, Federalists thinking that Democratic Republicans were just going to turn this into a complete chaotic situation. It was going to be anarchy.
Yeah.
And it's
a
just,
godless country.
Yeah. Hide your Bibles.
Yeah. I found it interesting digging into this for an episode that how rife the country was with conspiracy theories. I didn't realize that those went kind of all the way back. And during this election, you talk about each side thinking the other side is going to destroy the country. There were serious fears of the Illuminati.
Yeah.
And it went both ways and in such an incredible kind of way. Like the Federalists first were saying that, you know, these Democratic Republicans and their pro-France ways, they're in league with the Illuminati and they're taking over the Freemasons and they're going to separate, you know, government from the people and take over. And it wasn't some edge case belief. Like George Washington wrote that he believed this was the case and that the leader of the democratic societies, and he must have been talking about Jefferson, certainly wanted to separate the people from their government and had these Illuminati beliefs. And that to me is the idea. I mean, by this time, Washington was out of power, but the fact that he was still, you know, so in the Federalist camp and believing that. But then the Illuminati threat was flipped so that it was the Democratic Republicans saying, no, the Federalists are the Illuminati, this New England group of people that want to create this state religion and take over and have this sort of like religious monarchy. And they were a little bit better politically at convincing people. And that took hold. And that was, you know, one small factor against John Adams. And it was so interesting to me to think that, you know, we think about conspiracy theories nowadays and how it's not new.
No, it's not. And also, and one of the things that I love studying about this election is that you also had plots. You had folks who were thinking, oh, well, we've got to do everything we can to get X party or X candidate in or out. You know, case in point, in New York, part of the reason why Aaron Burr was on the ticket is that he was leading Democratic Republicans to take more power in the state like they had never before.
Yeah.
And you have Hamilton and others reaching out to John Jay, who at that point was the governor of New York, Federalist, and saying, you know, yeah, okay, we realize that Democratic Republicans are taking the state legislature, which means that the votes will go to Jefferson. How about we change how we choose the electors, like right now, and then we can figure out some way to throw those votes to Federalist candidates. And John Jay was like, no, the people chose. We lost.
Yeah.
We're not going to do that. We're not going to pull these shenanigans. But then on the other side, you also have these folks, and especially as we get, you know, further on and, you know, we're having to deal with what to do about this tie vote in the Electoral College, you have people reaching out to James Monroe, who was the governor of Virginia, and saying, if they try and stop Jefferson from becoming president, we need to raise a militia and march on Washington. We need to make sure we will have Jefferson as our president. And James Monroe was like, maybe we need to just cool down a little bit. I think it's going to work out, but, you know, we'll put a pin in that. But you had these plots and people really thinking, how can we manipulate this election?
Yeah. And you mentioned Burr in New York. I mean, New York was a big swing state. Mm-hmm. I mean, as New York went, so went the election in a lot of ways. And one of the episodes that I had the most fun digging into on Plotting Through the Presidents was about Burr's effort to create the Manhattan Company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I didn't realize, again, I related to modern elections. You think about COVID and the pandemic. In the election of 1800 and probably 1796 as well, one of the biggest threats to the country was yellow fever. It was something that, you know, it had literally decimated, taken out 10% of Philadelphia in 1793. There was another big outbreak in 1797, but New York City needed clean drinking water. They didn't understand that mosquitoes were the cause, but they understood that, like, something about the water, like, we don't want this stagnant water around. It can't be helping things. So Burr came up with this plan to create a water company that would bring clean water from this disgusting lake. So I don't know how the plan really was meant to work, but he convinced Alexander Hamilton to help champion this plan because he also wanted New York to have clean water. And Hamilton helped vouch for it. He got the charter for the Manhattan Company, but buried within, you know, the charter was this clause that any excess funds they had, they could use however they wanted. And so it really wasn't a water company at all. It was a ploy to create a bank. And that bank would be friendlier to Democratic Republicans than any of the banks that Hamilton ostensibly controlled. So that bank and the funds that it was able to help provide to Republican candidates and Republican, just Democratic Republican people in New York really helped sway the election in a way that Jefferson credited Burr and that bank with winning the election for the Republicans. And all because people were afraid of yellow fever. It's just, and one other thing about yellow fever that plays into this election and the politics around it, even disease, even treatments for disease were politicized. Like, there was a Democratic-Republican treatment for yellow fever, and that was Benjamin Rush bleeding you to death. Hopefully not to death, but it's what happened a lot. And then there was a Federalist treatment, which was just not doing that. So you have these two different sides to the point where this guy, William Cobbett, who wrote the Porcupine Gazette, which was this Federalist newspaper, if you could call it that. I think it was Abigail Adams' favorite newspaper, possibly, because it was one of the few that was so pro-Adams. He was calling out Benjamin Rush for, you know, kind of killing his patients with his treatment. And so Rush sued him for libel, and you had this big political trial that was really, I mean, it was really more about politics than anything. And, you know, Rush ended up winning, and Cobbett had to pay some money, but the damage was already done. And the decision came in December 1799, you know, on the eve of 1800, where these things were very much in people's minds. So it's just putting the world in that context of, you know, threats of disease and factions and fears of the Illuminati. And it really, really was. I mean, we talk about modern elections where maybe the fear of democracy is talked about, and not to invalidate that at all. But back then, you didn't have a history of hundreds of years of a country that somehow worked, with the exception of a civil war. You didn't have that history back then. So it was really a very fragile experiment. So all of these threats seemed extremely real, because you just didn't know that the country could survive any of them.
Absolutely. And Howard, that's an important point. And I always try and invite folks when talking about the early Republic, and especially, you know, I think we start to see some shifts after the War of 1812. But prior to that, this is all still very new, yeah. And they don't know if it's going to work out. And in fact, there are lots of folks who think, well, we'll give it a shot, but it will probably have to figure out something else. And you see this, you see people thinking about, okay, well, what happens if we have to break off, if this nation falls apart? And you start to see some of the regionalism also play into this, because you see, in terms of the electoral votes, you know, the Federalist ticket for Adams and Pinckney is really concentrated in New England. They do have votes from Delaware and New Jersey. They have all those votes, 5 votes from Maryland. And then Adams and Pinckney also picked up 7 votes from Pennsylvania and 4 from North Carolina. But it's really concentrated in this region. And meanwhile, yeah, Jefferson and Burr are taking votes from other parts of the Mid-Atlantic. They're taking New York. They're taking the rest of the Southern electors. They're taking all the electors from the West. And we see, as we go along, there are talks about secession. You know, we get to the War of 1812. We've got the New England push for secession. Yeah. You, at this point, you know, the West has been talking about seceding before you get Louisiana and get access to the Mississippi River. They don't know that this is actually going to work. And they, you get the sense of this insecurity in, and I think that that helps to spur some of these conspiracy theories and fears of what's going to happen if things change, if, heaven forbid, Jefferson becomes president.
Yeah. And I mean, you had, everybody had this common enemy of Britain, at least the, you know, the patriots, the folks who built the Constitution and first did the Declaration of Independence. Those folks were on the same side in a way for a while. But then when the Constitution is passed, when we start doing this, you know, new government, you really see folks almost like kind of flip when they realize what they build is being used by people they kind of disagree with. And it's interesting, like Gouverneur Morris, like the penman of the Constitution, who's just, he's a trip. I could go off on him. But, you know, the guy who wrote the preamble, the guy that was like, hey, we should start with we the people, which was a radical idea. You know, after Jefferson was elected, he was ready to tear up the Constitution. He's like, no, it wasn't meant for like them. Like, these ideas are crazy. So it's just so interesting that people work so hard to do something. And even James Madison and his huge metamorphosis from, you know, the Federalist to leading the Anti-Federalist Party, because the government that he worked hard to create started doing something that he disagreed with and had too much power. And yeah, I just, looking at people and how they changed based on whether or not they were in power and what the federal government was doing, but still they kept it going. And that's the, you know, I don't know if we're ready to jump ahead, but the outcome of the election of 1800 and how that power was transferred, to me, is the most consequential thing about that election. And that's what's amazing to me, is that all these things we've been talking about, all the reasons people truly just hated and despised the other side, they were still able to have an election with a peaceful transfer of power. And I mean, so much of that credit goes to John Adams for establishing that. People are like, he didn't even stick around for the inauguration. I mean, his son had just died. There was no precedent for that. You know, why would you want to go to a party where, you know, everybody hated you? So I don't really hold that against him. But you know, even if he stocked the courts with Federalists like John Marshall, who he knew was kind of a bitter political opponent of Jefferson's, there was that peaceful transfer of power. And that to me is huge and a testament to how much they wanted this new nation to work, even though they feared that it might not.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I wholeheartedly agree. And yeah, so let's, you know, we've got our electoral votes down and we've got a problem. We've got Jefferson and Burr who have the equal number of electoral votes. And so constitutionally, if no one candidate gets a majority of the electoral votes,
they just duel, right? They get to duel. Is that
they probably I think Burr may have been okay with dueling.
Yeah.
So it goes to the House of Representatives, and basically they vote by state. So at this point, 16 states have representatives in the House. So 9 state votes were needed to win, 8 plus 1. You would think, okay, everybody really knew Jefferson was supposed to be the presidential candidate. This is going to be easy to solve, right? Except here we go again with the plots, because you have some Federalists who look at Jefferson and Burr. You've got Jefferson, who they know, I mean, he's been vice president for 4 years. They've had a chance to get to know him if they didn't already, that this guy is really partisan. He is going to do things differently. Burr, on the other hand, yeah, he's partisan, but he's also kind of worked with Federalists in the past. He sometimes tries to get in this middle of the road thing. Maybe, I mean, he technically could become president. So maybe he would be easier to work with than Jefferson. And so you see in February, they start voting, start casting their ballots to break this tie. And you've got Jefferson, who gets 8 of the state votes. Burr gets 6. And then there are 2 state delegations that are divided. They do the first ballot, the second ballot, the third ballot, again and again. Nobody's winning. Nobody's
so you have changing. You have to get 9, was it?
You have to get 9.
Oh, this is such a crazy, complicated system. Like, not only does it get thrown to the House because there's not, well, the tie makes sense. But now, even if nobody gets a plurality or whatever of electoral votes, it goes to the House. But then you think, okay, the House of Representatives, everybody should get a vote. But no, it's by state. And I even think- there, it's not the majority. It's I don't know how they ever got this passed. It is clearly the culmination of some wacky compromises that nobody could have been happy with.
Yeah. And that's the problem. So, you know, and again, you have these conspiracy theories starting. You're having folks who are saying, well, I think the Federalists are just trying to run out the clock, because on March 4th, 1801, whether there's a president elected or not, the terms of John Adams as president and Thomas Jefferson as vice president end. If there's no president elected, who becomes president? Well, at that point, the next person on the list is the president pro tempore of the Senate, which means that whoever is chosen for that position, which basically the president pro tem is, if the vice president can't preside over the Senate, they elect another senator to fill that role.
At a certain point, does it just go back to King George? Like, like, you know what? We couldn't do it. We couldn't do it.
Let's follow the chain. Okay. Yeah, he's 72. On the list. But yeah, you've got people who are saying, you know, this is how Federalists, they're going to get a Federalist elected as the president pro tem.
Yeah.
And then he's going to become president. And that's their way of voiding the election. It's just, it's to us, it seems surreal. And also, it was a possibility.
You're telling me that there might be politicians who would try to run out the clock just so they could maintain some sort of power. I don't buy it.
I know. We've never heard of that before, have we? But to your point, Howard, you know, it ends up, there has to be something, there has to be some give somewhere. This is not working. They've done 10 ballots, they've done 20 ballots, nobody's budging. So behind the scenes, folks start talking. And meanwhile, we've got Hamilton, who's back in New York and hearing about this, and it's like, oh God.
Yeah.
Aaron Burr could become president. Mm. And Federalist would elect him. Are you kidding me?
Yeah, if there was anyone he hated more than Jefferson and Adams.
You've got to imagine what was going through Hamilton's head at this point. This is his worst nightmare.
Yeah, I mean, I think what's going through his head is like, oh, something's happening that I really don't like. I'm going to sit down and I'm going to write a pamphlet. And actually, I think the pamphlet happened before this Tide vote where he, you know, just wrote about how awful Adams was. But he'd already had a huge say in this election, and he probably helped sway some people against Adams, which, I mean, they're the same party, but he kind of dislikes the guy so much. And he sees that Adams probably isn't going to win anyway. So it's like this weird strategic plot to distance the Federalists from Adams so that when the Democratic Republicans win and they fail, then the Federalists can come back into power with Hamilton at the helm or whatever. But yeah, I think Hamilton did what he always does when he sees that things are going wrong, and he wrote some letters. And yeah, him chiming in there, it's hard to say just how consequential that was, but it was, I think, a pretty devastating blow to Burr.
Yeah. And meanwhile, you know, and this is something that we talked about in the Burr two-part episode. We can't find any evidence that Burr was actively campaigning. In fact, he was writing letters saying, are you kidding? I don't want to take any votes from Jefferson. Jefferson's supposed to be president. And you look at where Burr is at this point, it would be madness for him to try and exploit this, because he's really in the Democratic Republican faction now. You know, he just spent all this time and effort to get the party in the ascendancy in New York. And he's still young enough. Even if Jefferson serves two terms, there's going to have to be somebody who replaces him. He's well positioned. He's, you know, one of the big leaders in New York. There's no reason for him to think this is it. But that's how it's come down in history. Burr was manipulating this behind the scenes, but the primary evidence isn't there for that.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of thoughts on that. Burr was super ambitious, always. So no matter what, I don't see him being like, I'm not going to take the presidency if it's given to me. I think he definitely would have stepped into that role.
Oh, yeah.
Gladly.
If the vote would have gone his way, he would have gone ahead.
Yeah. And we talk about evidence. Burr is one of those figures who a lot of his personal letters just don't exist anymore. Mm-hmm. So, you know, Jefferson probably burned quite a few of his as well that were maybe the most maniacal or Machiavellian, I guess. But we still have a lot of evidence of the stuff he was doing behind the scenes. We don't have as much from Burr. So while I believe he wasn't actively campaigning for that role, I think there may be more that we just don't know about that. And there was enough going on that certainly Jefferson was convinced that Burr was not doing enough to make it clear that Jefferson should be president. And Jefferson held that against Burr forever, you know, to the point where as president, Jefferson was like, hey, what can I do to get Burr killed? Yeah, that was not a happy time between the two of them.
Yeah. And again, you think through, and this was a completely unprecedented, I mean, this was constitutional crisis time. And this is something that they hadn't experienced before. And so you kind of see, and again, that kind of insecurity in Jefferson's part that, oh, well, Burr's not doing enough. Well, what is he supposed to do? You know, what really needs to be done to move this along? He's saying, I don't I'm not going to campaign for votes against you, but you know, and you see this in the presidency at this time so many times. You see Washington doing this. You see Adams doing this. Oh, well, so-and-so just isn't doing enough.
Yeah.
But it's not really clear what they were supposed to do, but it creates a grudge and it creates these bad feelings. But just like with anything else, you know, the true Washington, D.C. way, backroom deals, because they know one way or another, a Democratic Republican, at least if they don't run out the clock and the president pro tempore is a Federalist and he becomes president. But by and large, they're finally coming to the realization, hey, a Democratic Republican is going to be president. Patronage. You've got all these Federalist office holders who are probably going to be out of a job because either Jefferson or Burr is going to have to reward some folks for helping them along the way. But maybe we can work out a deal where we go ahead and settle this thing and you don't turn them all out. Maybe we've got a few folks who just remain in place. You just leave them alone and we'll be fine. And so then we see, you know, the first 35 ballots, 35 ballots, 8 votes for Jefferson, 6 votes for Burr, 2 votes divided. So then we finally get to the 36th ballot and we see some votes shift. So this way Jefferson ends up not just with 9, but 1 extra, 10. Mm. He ends up with 10 of the state delegations voting for him, 4 for Burr and 2 divided. And so finally, we have Jefferson as the third president of the United States.
Wow, what a road, you know? Yeah. And so much of it, I mean, it's Hamilton's role in saying that, you know, Jefferson is all of these horrible things, sure, yeah, but Burr is so much worse and doesn't even have like a moral compass. You know, that's interesting. And then, so yeah, you have Jefferson step in and that's the revolution of 1800, as they like to call it.
Yeah. And, you know, to your point, Howard, you know, that's one thing that, again, this is one of those unprecedented times. You have a change of party. You have a president from one party who is giving way to a president of another party. How is this going to work? Is everybody going to be okay with it? What's going to happen? And to pretty much everybody's surprise, it's actually very peaceful. It's, you know, it isn't rioting in the streets. It isn't somebody trying to make a power play. It's just Adams leaves the White House. He goes home. Jefferson is inaugurated. He moves into the White House. It's done.
Yeah.
And I think to your point earlier, Howard, I think this is one of the greatest lasting legacies of this election is that we had a peaceful transfer of power. It established that precedent that's played out for the most part.
Yeah. Yeah. Yep. Yep. You're right. It's played out now, you know, but for a long time it was going. Yeah. No, it was huge. And it's something that, you know, you just take for granted. That's a part of the United States and how it works. And doesn't that happen everywhere? And you don't think that was a radical thing, that this transfer of power between political parties, I don't know if that ever happened anywhere before like that. Yeah. A uniquely American thing at the time that, you know, we're trying to spread and has had various degrees of success. But yeah, it really is incredible how it set the tone for future elections. And just gave people a faith in the system that, hey, there's a reason to vote. There's a reason we have elections. They're going to have consequences. And if you don't like the country, you can change it in these ways. You know, if that had gone differently, I don't think people would have had faith in the system. And I don't think it would have lasted nearly as long.
Yeah, exactly. This is one of those key moments. It's one of those key legacies that helps build what was to come. And with this new system, this was only the 4th presidential election ever in the U.S. They're still relying a lot on faith. that this is actually going to work out like it should, like the plan. And that faith has to continue. And this helps to build that and strengthen that, that yes, we are going to have peaceful transfers of power. If one party isn't doing what they should, they can be voted out and new leadership can come in. And that's an amazing thing. It's also so precious.
Yes.
It's so precious.
And you talked about how that wasn't just something that happened. That depended on a lot of people following the system, even like James Monroe in Virginia saying, hey, you know, let's not plan to take up arms if there's a result we don't like. And James Monroe, you know, he just wanted to shoot people. Like, so for him to say, let's be cool about this. That's pretty big, because they all had this kind of sense of honor that they had agreed to this political system and an agreed set of truths and results and things that they would do, that enough of them stuck to make it work.
Yeah. Yeah. And we see in, with Jefferson taking power, yes, there were some of these backroom deals of, let's just go ahead and keep this person in place in this federal position. But really, Jefferson is even like, you know what? I don't want to completely clear house. There are some Federalists who are in office who are doing a good job. Why would I want to mess with that? Yes, there are some replacements. Yes, he does get some Federalists out. Yes, they do try and completely upend the judicial system and try and get John Marshall out. I think that was his ultimate goal with all the impeachment trials. But
yeah,
you still have this idea that we're going to keep going and we're not going to completely overturn everything, you know, and you even see some of the Democratic Republicans, you know, those folks who were so opposed to the national bank, who you get to the recharter of the bank in Madison's presidency, and they're like, you know what, this really is a good idea. Hamilton was right about this.
Maybe it's a good idea to have some money around.
A stop clock is right at least twice a day.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. No, it's totally agree. How they, and I think it comes back to that sort of sense of honor. And they wanted to be seen as, you know, respectable people who believed in the American experiment. So it kind of helped that there was this feeling that you can be sneaky as hell behind the scenes. You can do all this kind of nefarious stuff to try to convince people, but you're trying to convince them to vote certain ways, you know, to play the game of the election at least, and follow these rules. But outside of that, you don't have to be, you know, good and moral or honest in a lot of ways, but you still have to kind of play this game. Yeah, that's sort of the agreement they came to, and they were certainly playing politics behind the scenes.
Absolutely. But as kind of a coda to this, as we're wrapping up our conversation on the election of 1800, there's one more person that I want to talk about, John Adams.
Yeah.
Howard, what's your impression of Adams's processing of this electoral loss for him and having to go into retirement?
Yeah, I think it was a mixed bag. I think that the idea of going home, you know, hanging out with Abigail in a house that wasn't leaking everywhere, you know, I think that a lot of him was okay with that idea. But his pride, I think, was very hurt by not being reelected. You know, serving as president, I don't think he enjoyed that all that much, but having the knowledge that his country wanted him to be president was probably more important to him. So I look at that and I think it was, you know, probably the best thing for him in a lot of ways to be sort of relieved of that. But I do think that, you know, going on with his perpetual feeling that history would slight him, I think that his efforts during his administration to avoid war with France and things he did around that really weren't rewarded or seen in the light that they should have been. And so much of his presidency, even now, is focused on the Alien and Sedition Acts, which I think are, you know, they were a terrible idea. They were certainly against the First Amendment, against the spirit of the country. And even though the idea was to, you know, avoid war or civil war with, you know, these pro-French people who he thought would, you know, just have all this unrest, there were reasons behind it that you can understand. And I feel like maybe the worst thing about Abigail Adams was she was probably egging him on to sign these and was all for it. But I think that we forget that they were set to expire in March of 1801 anyway, the Sedition Acts, which most people had the problem with. So there's not this idea that Jefferson was coming in and rescuing the country from these terrible acts. Like, they were going to go away anyway. And I think that it's funny that Adams later blamed Hamilton for the Alien and Sedition Acts, which isn't fair at all. Like, they didn't really come from him. But I think that John Adams processed it in his sort of grumpy way, but I think it completely fit with him being used to being slighted and not respected. So I think when he was elected president, that must have just blown his mind, because it's something he always thought he deserved and should have gotten. Even next to Washington, he was a little upset that, you know, he got so few votes compared to Washington, but still came in as vice president. So it's interesting looking at how everything kind of affected him. But yeah, it was, you know, a little sad to see him go after just one term. He became the first one-term president until his son, you know.
Well, and it's interesting because as turbulent as his first term was, you know, I keep thinking it seems like most presidents, the second term is worse.
Yeah.
And so I think of John Adams and it's like, oh my gosh, he may have dodged a bullet there.
Yeah.
If it got worse than his first term, what was going to happen?
Especially if Jefferson was still his vice president and working against the system from within. Yeah, it probably wouldn't have been good.
Yeah. And especially like Jefferson as vice president, Hamilton still operating behind the scenes.
Yeah.
His former cabinet members working against him. It would have been, you know, it probably was for the best for Adams, but I think, Howard, you really get to the point, his ego, sense of pride was hurt, and understandably so. You know, he felt like he had done good things, and in particular, avoiding war with France, a war that he knew the country wasn't ready for. So many people knew the country wasn't ready for, but you still had those war hawks who were pushing, and he spent basically 4 years fighting against that and trying to find a diplomatic solution, and he achieved it, and then he went home.
Yeah.
And that was it.
Yeah, so that being his legacy, that and the first peaceful transfer of power between political parties is a pretty great legacy to have, and I think you're right. If there had been a second term, it might have been even worse for him. I think that his personality, his temperament, a lot of the things that, you know, weren't his best qualities might have just been exacerbated if he had to spend 4 more years in that White House, in that political turmoil. So maybe it was best for him and the country that he went home and left that legacy when he did.
Well, I think that is a good place to wrap up our conversation. Howard, as always, I cannot thank you enough. It's always a pleasure to talk presidential history with you. And I cannot recommend Plotting Through the Presidents enough. Just keep up the good work. And thank you so much to you and Jess for all that you do, for all the insight that you provide to so many people, and really bringing presidential history to folks who may not have had a good experience with history in grade school, but really seeing that these are people that we can relate to and understand, and that historians don't always get it right. So thank you for the work that you do.
Oh, thanks. I really appreciate that, Jerry. And thanks for having me on the show. It's an absolute pleasure.
Thank you. And for our listeners, thank you for joining us. I hope that this conversation helped to enlighten your knowledge of the election of 1800. Of course, there are so many books available about that election. If you want to do more of a deep dive, check it out. You can check out episodes of Plotting Through the Presidents and the Presidency's podcast that cover it. I imagine that we'll end up coming back to it again at some point. Who knows? But I hope that this has been enlightening for you. Thank you so much for joining us. And until next time, stay safe and healthy, be kind to one another, and take care, dear friends.
I'm Ken Harbaugh, host of Burn the Boats from Evergreen Podcasts. I interview political leaders and influencers, folks like award-winning journalist Soledad O'Brien and conservative columnist Bill Kristol, about the choices they confront when failure is not an option. I won't agree with everyone I talk to, but I respect anyone who believes in something enough to risk everything for it. Because history belongs to those willing to burn the boats. Episodes are out every other week wherever you get your podcasts.